Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of One Vision, the FinTech Views. This is Theo and Barb, your host for the episode. And joining us today is a wonderful mutual friend of ours, Matthew Siegel, the Global ESG and Sustainability Advisor at Microsoft and author of the ESG Advocate newsletter, as well as an upcoming book, The ESG Mindset. Welcome back to the show, Matthew.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, so this is going to be a lot of fun because we do want to spend time to talk about your book. But before we do that, now, as someone who self-described as a benevolent troublemaker, and I did not make that up because that is on your LinkedIn profile, get us up to speed on what's new with you and how has 2024 been treating you so far?
Oh my gosh. Yes, I am a self-described benevolent troublemaker, and I do get in a lot of trouble for pushing around companies, including Microsoft, in directions that I think we need to go, both from an ESG perspective, but also an impact perspective. This topic is so broad and deep that 2024 has been kind of a hot mess so far. It's almost as if a light switch flipped in January. I am significantly more busy than I was the last year. And I'm trying to stay on top of as much as I can, research the news, write to try to, like, that's how I think through these issues. But the number of RFPs that have been coming out around this topic, the anti-ESG drum continues to beat, which is bizarre to be releasing a book around this topic when all that's going on. It has just been absolutely bananas this fiscal year, this calendar year so far.
So for those that don't know, you know, in addition to writing the book, you're writing a regular newsletter as well. So I encourage everyone to go click subscribe. And earlier this year, you wrote a letter to CEOs and you titled it the ESG Advocates 20 CEOs. And within you said, ESG is complicated. Is this like the new Facebook status? It's complicated. So tell us a bit more about that. And, you know, what are some of the misconceptions about ESG?
Yeah, I love the way you put it. The Facebook status is, that's kind of, I should have framed it that way when I wrote the letter. Yes, it is very complicated. And I already kind of touched on it in my first answer, which is, ESG is not necessarily some things that people think about, like impact, for example. So let's start off with the definition. I'm going to try to do this whenever I talk about ESG. The definition I use from the book, which is ESG is the material, environmental, social, and corporate governance risks that affect a company and the opportunities that drive it towards long-term value and sustainable growth, which means that ESG is not a couple of things that we've heard about. For example, it is not necessarily the impact of the world, the company on the world, but it is the effect that the world and its people have on the company. But this makes it really complicated because there are complex intersections between things like externalities. What is the company putting out there? And things that might influence back in. So for example, if a company is a heavy polluter, there might be regulations that impacted on the way back in, and those externalities may give it fines and things like that. So it's really, really complicated. Now, the reason why I wrote that is because I was addressing a Wall Street Journal article that was titled "The Latest Dirty Word in Corporate America, ESG." So who actually said ESG is complicated is this guy, Daryl Brewster, who heads the Chief Executives for Corporate Purpose Group. Now, what he doesn't talk about, which I cover in the book, is why ESG is so complicated specifically. And there's really three reasons that I found when thinking about it from the corporate perspective. First off is interconnected risks, which I wrote about recently. A great example, which is also horrible, is commercial real estate. There's $1.2 trillion of global commercial real estate debt coming up for refinance in the next 3 years, which is kind of a governance issue. A lot of coastal cities and even Chicago is sinking into the oceans. And there's all kinds of climate risks associated with cities and really working anywhere with things like wildfires, as I know, Barb, you know, we know in the US, we know in Canada. And then also post-COVID, there's a huge social impact because 40% of workers want to work remotely, which means those buildings are largely sitting empty. So you have this weird web of interconnected risks. Now that's the first thing. The second thing is globalization. The rise in globalization over the past 30 years has been massive. An example of that is we have two different global shipping routes under siege right now for two different reasons. We have Panama Canal suffering from a climate risk, which is drought, and the Suez Canal suffering from attacks on ships and then those logistic routes getting rerouted, extending the time on that. So globalization is playing a huge risk as well. And then intangibles. And I know this is a topic that you both talk about, like things like technology. In 2015, Ocean Tomo released a report that I think it was 80% of a company's value now sits in intangibles. And this covers things like their brand, their reputation, but also technology, things like cybersecurity, new risks around AI. Now, this is all why I love ESG, though, because it's so complicated that there's no straightforward answers, which means you could just think about it all day and then pull the trigger, like make a best effort decision and pull the trigger and see if it's going to work or not. It's just completely fascinating to me.
I have to laugh when you're talking. All I can think of is a plate of spaghetti with cheese melted all around it. And you try to pull it and it's just a mess.
Yeah.
A mess or opportunity depends on how you look at it. Now, for you, as our dear friend, you have an upcoming book coming out called ESG Mindset that's published by our joint publisher, Colgan Page. So I think that is in itself an opportunity for you to get your message out and to teach a broader scope of audience what it is about, because as you say, there is complicated and there's a lot of misconceptions about it. So tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind the book, why that topic and why now, and what are some of the key messages you would like your readers to walk away with?
Yeah, the inspiration behind the book is really a story about how I came into this space. So I was in financial services. It was before 2020, and I was aligned directly with some of the world's largest ESG data aggregators. I had never heard of ESG before, and I was like, what is this topic? And so I started to research it. I found out it was data. I work at Microsoft. Obviously, I wanted to help them with their data estates. But as I started listening to other organizations at Microsoft and how they were approaching their customer challenges, I kept finding ESG. And I would reach out to the account teams and I would say, your customer's talking about ESG issues. Like, do you understand what this means? And of course, you know, this was prior to 2020, nobody really understood what it was. And so as I started my own learning on this, on ESG, I found that there was hardly any content out there that focused on companies. Most of the content was focused on financial services because ESG was born out of the UN Environmental Program Finance Initiative. Like, it is a financial idea, but it applies to companies. And so you would think that somebody would be telling companies like how financial services were looking at them, but I found nothing really. There was one book, which I'll talk about later, called Gloom to Boom, that was the only one that I found with very practical advice, but really there was nothing. So I went out and kind of wrote the book that I wanted a few years ago in order to come into this topic, to try to help everybody from the board to individual contributors really, really make sense of this topic. Now, what I'm hoping companies and boards and individual contributors take away from this is that companies can only impact the issues that surround all of us by coming at it through the lens of their business. In other words, learning about the material intersections of E, S, and G from their business perspective, and then going out and working on those issues as only they can. So in the book, I talk about like Paramount has a great program to support diverse and inclusive content. That is how Paramount can impact the social pillar. I also talk about the Beverage Industry Environmental Roundtable, which just released an updated report this past January that talks about things like the beverage industry reducing water usage, because that is core to their products and it takes more water to make a bottle of soda than it does to actually drink the soda. Like, it takes more water to make the product than it is actually in the product. Like, these are material issues that only these companies can impact in the way that they operate. And in order to move the needle, in order to get from managing these risks and opportunities to moving the needle, you have to start from what is core and what is material to your business. Otherwise, what I see out there is a lot of companies leading with philanthropic efforts, like, and they're great, employee volunteer efforts, you know, cleaning up your local park, replacing, doing table stakes things like replacing LED light bulbs in your building, but ultimately, none of that is going to move the needle forward on the most systemic issues we have. You have to use this material lens to kind of get there. So that's the big inspiration and the takeaway that I hope people get from it.
So I love a good origin story. I love that this is a bit of a re-origin for you, maybe. And for those that don't know your background, you know, how does the English major end up, you know, having this long career at Microsoft? The reasons why, you know, people with diverse backgrounds are really important for our teams. And so I applaud you definitely for that. And I've been so happy that you're leveraging that skill set by way of your regular newsletter and now the book. And so you've been telling us about, you know, there's an interconnectedness underneath all of this E, S, and G. And let's then talk about the topic du jour, you know, for the last 14 months. Generative AI. We're not going to let you escape this one without talking about this. So how would you recommend companies approach this topic with an ESG mindset?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I really appreciate what you said about my English major. Yes, I try to leverage my own skills to move the needle forward because that's what I'm good at. So in the book, I do have a chapter specifically dedicated to technology. And the reason why is in that book that I just mentioned, Bloom to Boom, by Dr. Andrea Bonin Blanc, who coincidentally, she wrote the foreword to the book, she adds technology as a fourth pillar. And the reason why is because it has the same intersections with material risks and opportunities that all the other ESG pillars have. Now, when it comes to generative AI specifically, I think that this is a phenomenal parallel to ESG. In fact, I was at a private equity summit recently with maybe about 100 participants, and it was a mix of PE firms and portcos, and it was generative AI summit. And as they were talking through the examples, the challenges, I couldn't tell, honestly, if I was at a generative AI talk or an ESG talk, because the fundamental challenges and the approaches to generative AI are nearly identical to those of ESG. It involves getting control of your data, securely breaking down data silos. It involves finding, like, not skunk work projects, but meaningful projects to pursue. There's so many parallels between the two. I think it's a great example. And it's also getting board level attention, just like ESG had been and hopefully continues to. Like, both are permeating these organizations in kind of the same way. Now, when it comes to thinking about generative AI with an ESG mindset, that is a phenomenal question. And there's, I do cover it a little bit in the book, but I'll just call out a couple of things. First off, obviously generative AI would have a huge impact on the environment. There are lots of servers needed. There are lots of storage needed. Thinking about things like, how high of a quality do you need to train those models after they're trained in order to get accuracy, and what the carbon footprint is? These play into things like cost too, but really you have to understand the environmental impact of what you might be building. From a social and governance perspective, it is critical to make sure that everybody in the company understands generative AI, at least at the surface level. But for practitioners, you have to understand things like responsible AI, which Microsoft has a responsible AI framework for. You have to understand things like ethics when you're building these models. Otherwise, you risk bias, you risk backlash. One of the things I hadn't seen until just last week was board level governance guidance for AI. So a group of all women board members released, they're called the Athena Alliance. They released an AI governance playbook specifically for boards to think through this issue, which I had not seen before, but it is getting discussed at the board level and needs that same type of oversight as any other core business issues. And also asking just basic questions like, do I have a diverse perspective when I'm implementing the tool internally? Now, there are also a lot of risks with this, and it goes beyond the simple risks of, am I losing a competitive advantage by not doing something with generative AI? You have to also consider things like protecting privacy, cybersecurity. But even if you don't do generative AI, there's a risk. So we just recently saw in Hong Kong that fraudsters conned $25 million out of a finance worker with using deep fake technology. Like, there are risks that even you can't control if you don't even use generative AI, which is also, by the way, a great parallel for ESG, because there are absolutely ESG risks that even if you don't focus on it, especially if you don't focus on it, you will likely get hit with, whether it's some sort of environmental climate risk, whether it's some sort of cancel culture, whether your board's not paying attention to certain material issues. Even if you ignore these things, you're putting yourself at risk.
Inaction is not a strategy. Man, do I love that message.
Yeah.
Inaction is not a strategy. Maybe we should put the title of the episode with that, right? Inaction is not a strategy. Although I feel like the topic can be so broad, though, that we seem to be lost as to where to start, right? So that's another way of looking at it. And I want to point to a recent SEC climate rule. That's how I feel sometimes when we look at, you know, what exactly is the SEC doing and how are companies supposed to respond, specifically around how it has been worded and how scope 3 was removed. Now, some people felt it was being watered down so much to the point where it is not effective anymore. And I know you recently wrote about that as well, Matthew. What do you think about that? Because we want guidance and we want to be able to hold companies accountable for their actions. We want them to think through things and we want them to understand the material impact, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But are we actually going to be able to do anything, or is this more like a check in the box exercise?
Yeah, disclosures are tough. I have very strong opinions, as you know, because we talk about this regularly and I post about it regularly. Broadly speaking, and in talking with sustainability practitioners who have been in this field for decades, unlike myself and some other folks, you know, there was a time when those people were doing meaningful work. What they told me was when the disclosures came out, largely that meaningful work stopped and they became carbon and environmental accountants, which and many of them, what prompted me to reach out to them was I saw many leaving what I had considered to be quality companies who were, and by quality, I mean, they were addressing these issues, I had thought. And when I reached out to them, they're like, yeah, we stopped addressing the issues and we just became carbon accountants. Now, having said that, there is value in the disclosures. However, the disclosures were born out of finding comparable data for financial services to make an investment or lending decision. Like, that is what the goal of the disclosures are. When you have that goal, that is what you're going to get. So investors hopefully get the comparable information they're looking for. Although, even I could tell you that with voluntary standards, that is not what I'm hearing. Even with these regulations, it is still a mess out there. What I'm hoping is, though, that we can get past this and back to the meaningful work. Now, in some ways, the SEC rule specifically, I think, has backfired on the entire anti-ESG movement, which is just, I am completely riveted by this. So the anti-ESG movement started in conservative states in the US who were concerned about energy boycotts from big institutional investors. They sent letters to the CEO of BlackRock. They have made blacklists in Texas on banks that they won't work with and things like that. Pension funds, you know, have said we won't work with these banks. But what's fascinating about the SEC rule is that it is actually an ESG rule, not just the sustainability disclosure. And what I mean by that is they have said that if you have material scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, you need to disclose. And this is just part of it, by the way. What scope 1 and scope 2 is, scope 1 are things that you burn directly, And scope two are things that you pay others to burn, mostly energy and utilities. And so by taking this material approach, which is what the SEC's job is, they have put like a target on the back of energy companies, utilities, materials like concrete, think concrete construction, to say these issues are material to you. You, out of all the industries, need to report on these issues. And I don't see a lot of people talking about this. There's a great read by S&P Global Sustainable One on this topic. I wrote about it last week, as you point out. But I feel like there is a really specific rule. Like, this is a really specific rule targeted for one group. And by leaving out scope three, the SEC is almost saying, and granted, energy, utilities, materials, those are large contributors to our global emissions. The SEC is kind of saying, you industries need to go figure this out because you're kind of the problem. I'm curious to see how this ends up playing out because they're effectively, I feel like they've effectively enacted a policy almost. It's very close. So we'll have to see. Now, having said all of that, there was also an article in the Wall Street Journal that BlackRock has, like, something to the effect that BlackRock has stopped saying ESG, even though they've stopped saying it, they haven't stopped doing it, and that they're focused on the energy transition opportunity specifically. To me, this also very closely parallels the SEC's movement here, where BlackRock is now saying, we're going to support energy transition and make the investments and find the opportunities for renewables and things like that. So I think we're at this really interesting inflection point that I don't know that anybody was really ready for 2 years ago when the SEC launched its draft proposal, which is not how it ended up. It didn't end up being like its draft really at all. It's fascinating.
It is. I think it took me a little bit by surprise, or maybe we shouldn't. We knew something was coming, and we knew there was a lot of pushback as to what was going into the content. The parts you just mentioned about BlackRock changing it to energy transition, that is the part about opportunity that you were talking about at the beginning of the show. You say, right, risk that impact the company and the opportunity for growth. Yeah. And I felt like the backlash has been focused so much on what about me? What about me? You're hurting me, that we forgot the other part, which is the transition part, which a lot of companies actually outside of the US are focusing on. So I hope that we can do a little bit more on that front, because it will benefit the environment and it will also benefit the companies from a long-term viability perspective. I don't understand why we would push back on that one, but then again. So before we close, any predictions? I know we're asking you for a crystal ball on what we might see in the space for the next 12 to 18 months. And most importantly, where can listeners find out more about your upcoming book and how do they connect with you?
Sure. So I think one thing I'd say is commercial real estate is like getting really specific. I would keep an eye on commercial real estate and see how it develops over the next 12 to 18 months. There are global policy government people who are working on stress testing around this exact issue. And I'm not sure that they fully understand the interconnected nature of it beyond the lending book that's coming due. So I'm super curious if you're looking for like an ESG news story to follow, that would be the one that I would say. Now, I'd also say over the next 12 to 18 months, I don't see ESG going anywhere. In the past 2 years, I've talked to over 300 companies and firms about this topic. Even with greenhushing, which is a trend that started as there's been this anti-ESG pullback, I haven't seen companies stop their efforts or even pivot their efforts. In fact, there was a great article in the Financial Times called Companies Pull Back on Sustainability Advice as Demands Shift. Now, while that title sounds disheartening, when you read it, what it actually says is that things are changing at the company and they're moving from kind of table stakes sustainability advice and reporting into figuring out their unique impact on the world, which is what I wrote about in the book. So I'm optimistic that companies are starting to get it. They're sitting on this reporting data and they're like, wait a minute, there is actually business value in this. I can see that my revenues are low over here and my carbon is high. How can I make an investment to maybe make sustainability a differentiator in my product? Or, you know, there's maybe unionization going on, which has been a huge trend last year in the US. Maybe there's a way that I can get ahead of this by paying a working wage, by focusing on issues like pay equity. Like, there are ways with an ESG mindset that you can think about these issues and at least attempt to get ahead of them. You're not always going to get it 100% right, but just try to get ahead of them a little bit. So maybe that when things hit, the impact isn't as bad. And I'm starting to optimistically see companies start to make that shift. So the way that I close the book, because I kind of feel like there's a lot of calls for ESG to go away, whether it's from some in academia calling it, the Wall Street Journal publishes an article fairly regularly now about ESG is dead. It doesn't matter what you call it. Like, I called it ESG in the book. Academics have names for it now. You can't avoid this topic. And if you try to, you will find that you'll be in trouble. So what I try to suggest is timing the end of it well in your companies. And I think Microsoft actually has done a really good job of this, because we're really good at ESG, but we don't talk about ESG because we've kind of permeated it through the culture. So everybody kind of knows how to deal with issues and like where things are important, what our sustainability goals are, how we go to market with it, our social impact as well, but we don't talk about it. But I don't find a lot of companies are like Microsoft either. So you have to really try to time it well. So people, I'm more than happy to talk to people about this topic. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about it. People can find out more about the book at esg-mindset.com. It is coming out from Kogan Page. So you can also find it on Kogan Page's website. I'm very active on LinkedIn. You literally can't miss me. So just search for me on LinkedIn and you will see me there. And I also expect to be speaking at a number of events coming up. So if you're at an ESG or sustainability event, keep an eye out for me. You might run into me.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have passionate people on the show. It's the one time maybe that I'm disappointed we don't publish this as video, because there's a shared passion here. The first time that we've ever had three Millennium Falcons in the background while we're recording. So I thank both of you for your shared passions that you share with me.
Of course.
You know what? You're right, Barb. Well, maybe we can do a picture. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Matthew, don't forget about your newsletter, the ESG Advocate. Yeah. So make sure you guys sign up for it. It's like reading a chapter every week, literally. The amount of time and energy and thought that you put into it, dissecting the issue of the week, is much, much appreciated. So thank you so much. And it's wonderful. Can't wait to see your book and actually have it in our hands. So thank you so much for joining us for our show this week and talk about your book. And for the rest of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of One Vision. We'll talk to you all next week.